change happens within systems change efforts, and you have to, as a coalition, be able to have these checkpoints to listen and learn and reflect and then take action based on the change that is happening. And the work that you're doing now may be completely different than what you started as doing, and that's okay.
Hey everyone, it's Hildy, and this is the Creating the Future podcast. I'm glad you've joined us here today. This is a place for us to explore what really creates social change. What will actually create the healthy, joyful future we all want to live in? I'm so happy that David Martinez is joining us for the podcast today. David is the Director of Strategic Community Partnerships at Vitalist Health Foundation, a foundation that looks at health through a systems change lens. Prior to his work at Vitalist, David has had the sort of winding path that adds wisdom and experience at every turn, from lobbying to community engagement, from food banking to teaching middle school. When I talk with David, that breadth of experience so obviously informs his approach to systems change and coalition building. And so it is my joy to welcome David Martinez to the podcast today. Welcome to the podcast, David. It is just such a pleasure to see you. It is always a pleasure for me to talk with you.
Thank you so much for having me, Hildy. Great to join you.
I'm wondering if, as we start, if you could just let our listeners know a little bit about what is it in your life that led you to be so passionate about creating change?
I always love this question, especially as it's framed, just how did you end up working at a foundation? Because it's not like most of us in philanthropy don't wake up or grow up thinking, I'm going to work in philanthropy. So unless maybe you're from a family foundation, you inherit a family fortune. But yeah, I love this story. I love this question because my story is really reflective of opportunity to make change, and a story hopefully that inspires folks to recognize that anybody can make change. Because I am a proud native son of Southern Arizona. I was born in the rural parts of Marana, Arizona, just northwest of Tucson. And one of six kids, I am the middle child. So at a quick age, I had to learn how to advocate for myself. I had to fight for just about everything. And I got that really from my parents, the work ethic, because both my parents are migrant farm workers. My dad eventually became an aircraft mechanic and was the breadwinner of our family of eight. My mom was a stay-at-home mom and took care of us six kids, as well as served as the neighborhood babysitter, because that still is an issue in a lot of parts of rural country. And they're just fighters. They mean a lot to me. My family means a lot to me. But being the middle child is always tough, as I'm sure some of your listeners can attest to. And then growing up, I had a lot of love in my household. We didn't have much, but we never went without. When I was growing up, I knew there was something a little bit different about me always. And I come to find out later that I was experiencing this awakening as a young man, and I didn't know exactly what it was, but ultimately came out to my mom initially and then to my close immediate family as a gay man. And it was still challenging because, as many folks know, growing up in rural parts of the country, and still as much advancements as we've made in society and in the LGBTQ movement, there's still a lot of hate, a lot of stigma. So I kind of stayed in the closet, actually, up through high school. And it wasn't until I went to college at the University of Arizona where I really began to spread my wings and fly and ultimately came out. And through that journey, and it is still a journey, you really learn how to advocate for yourself, for your community. And ever since then, I've been just unapologetically an advocate for the LGBTQ community, for equality, and causes that are important to our community. And those aspects are all about creating change and striving for something better for our community. I was the first in my family to go to college. I'm a proud Wildcat, but that itself was a journey because my family didn't know the first thing about higher education. I remember taking home the federal application for student aid, the FAFSA form, and I had to ask my dad for his social security number and his income statements and all of these things, and he was so distressing. And I'm like, no, this is good. This is how we'll be able to go to the university. And it was really challenging. Even though I did well in high school, I was really involved in the community and student government, but still felt out of place. But kept fighting, kept advocating for myself, found my niche eventually, and never turned back. Eventually graduated from the U of A with a teaching degree, actually. So had the great opportunity to be a middle school social studies teacher at Ross Scrooge Middle School in Tucson Unified School District, which I absolutely loved.
Wow. Well, I have had a theory for a long time that anybody who teaches middle school goes straight to heaven. That you can kill people, you can rob, you can do it. You go straight to heaven. If you can teach middle school and love it, you go straight to heaven.
Well, I appreciate that nod because it was definitely a challenge for sure. Middle school students are quite something, but I really enjoyed it because I always like to say they were old enough to know better, but young enough to mold. So I feel like I had this really great opportunity, and I love government and social studies and civics, and I just absolutely love teaching, but it was so challenging. That was at the beginning of the Great Recession. So teachers were being reduced in force, budgets were being cut, and that ultimately shifted to my move to become a community organizer for education issues. Eventually moved up to the big city of Phoenix to lobby at the Capitol on those same issues, which was really helpful because having to herd 160 middle school students was very much like being a lobbyist actually at the state capitol. So again, there's a through line with skill sets and backgrounds into things that are helpful. And that was challenging as well. It was just really difficult times, but really found a new community here in Phoenix and began working at St. Mary's Food Bank Alliance, which is kind of the sister food bank to the Community Food Bank of Southern Arizona, and help build their child nutrition programs. Because of my background in education, I think my skill sets as a community organizer and a lobbyist really help speak the language of folks that work in schools and try to get them to open up and expand our programs in their after-school programs and summer programs so that kids who would otherwise go without food had access to it. And I deepened my experience at the food bank, ended up working there for 7 years, but wanted to go back to school, actually. So I knew that it would be an easier route if I go back to get a master's, if I actually work at the university as an employee, and had a great opportunity to work at a think and do tank based out of Arizona State. Yes, I am a Wildcat and ended up working at Arizona State University.
We will try and forgive you for that.
It's all right. It's an organization called the Center for the Future of Arizona. And I really, really loved working there because I was able to help grow their civic health programs, but also as a native Arizonan, really advocate for more young people like me to connect to being in Arizona, in their community, in whatever way they wanted to connect in their community, and find a reason to help us make it better, to help us make it the Arizona we want, as our report's title reflects. And I think that experience really just built this really stronger network that I have here in Phoenix. And I had always engaged with this, you know, organization called Vitalist Health Foundation from my food bank days and from other community engagement opportunities. And I knew that a position had opened up, but I had set a 5-year plan at the Center for the Future of Arizona. I was going back to school to get my master's. But a great component, I think, of creating change is building a strong network of supporters and advocates who are championing yourself, but also that are standing side by side with you in this movement. And I had one of those advocates that encouraged me to apply for a role at Vitalist Health Foundation. And Hilly, that was 6 years ago, which seems like a world ago because a lot has changed since then.
Oh my gosh. What a 6 years.
Yeah, it's been so much fun being here at Vitalist. I now direct our grants program, which includes our capacity building efforts for the nonprofit ecosystem, including coalitions, and what we call our civic health portfolio, which is really how Arizonans are coming together every day to tackle their toughest challenges. And because we're a health foundation, we focus on how those communities are coming together to improve the health of their neighbors, their communities, our state, and we think eventually our country and our democracy. So it's just been a true pleasure. And to be able to be in this role, to connect with everyday Arizonans who are doing the most incredible things and then leverage resources is incredible. And the way that we have framed our Vitalist resources and partnership opportunities is all around creating change, supporting system change efforts, and the really critical components like coalitions and collaborative networks that really make that happen.
Well, you have led right into the question that this podcast is all about, which is what is it that actually creates change? But I love the path of your story, that it wasn't intentional. It wasn't, I'm going to be this. But it really is sometimes where life takes you and just being open to that.
Yeah, I like the concept of having this North Star. And I think those are always important. But I really didn't imagine that I would be working at a foundation. I don't even think I really knew what a foundation is. I know that sometimes my family doesn't even know what I do. But I know that they're proud of me. I'm proud of the work that we've been able to do here at Vitalist Health Foundation. We have a great team and a great leader in Suzanne Feaster, our president and CEO. And it's just been a blast.
Well, we've always loved Vitalist, even from the days before you were calling yourselves Vitalist. So I'm really, really glad that you're with us today. That leads me right into the question at the core of this podcast, which is, in your experience, what is it that actually creates change? What are the factors that you see happening when you see change happening?
Hildy, I love being able to reflect on my own background and history because it really does feed into the different components needed to make change. One of the things that I learned quickly as an organizer and a lobbyist is that you have to want something. You have to want the change. You have to advocate for the change. You have to ask for the change. And I think that identifying that end goal, what is the change you're really trying to make, is really important, especially as you're looking at identifying those root causes of the problems that exist in our society. So here at Vitalist, that is our approach. We really look at these upstream interventions that are tackling those root causes of historic health disparities that exist. And that's how we've framed our programmatic work. That's how we framed our grant work. Why we were encouraging more folks in the nonprofit ecosystem to take a more systems change approach, a more upstream approach to improving health, rather than, say, just a downstream intervention, which is very important work. We don't throw shade on it. It's so important for the groups that are doing these downstream interventions, that are doing the programmatic direct service work, very critical, because there are needs of individuals happening today that need to be addressed. At the same time, we want folks to take a systems change level, again, those upstream approaches, to tackle the root causes. Why is that problem there in the first place? And my background really in food banking really helped me better understand this, because the food bank sector does such critical work to distribute food boxes and alleviate hunger today for people that are experiencing hunger today. Too many people, too many kids experience hunger. We know the data, right? Especially here in Arizona, especially in rural and tribal parts of our communities. So very important work. But here at Vitalist, very rarely will you see us support a food bank and their direct service work, their programmatic work, and say distributing food boxes. Where we do have our support is more of that upstream intervention of tackling the food system. And why are people having to go to the food bank in the first place? So a lot of our great systems change grant partners have been tackling that issue. And we've been supporting coalitions, working on the food systems, identifying why healthy local food isn't staying local to address those hunger needs, including things like farmland preservation, which is a really unique take at this. So one of the things I love about my job at Vitalist is that I'm able to meet these super passionate people that are working to tackle systemic change in really innovative and unique ways, like preserving farmland, so that as we grow as a state, we're doing so in a smart way that enables farms that have been in families for generations and generations are able to stay in their family's hands or stay as farmland, and that healthy local food can go back into the local food system. We see this here in the urban area of Phoenix, where I'm at now, but we especially see this in rural and tribal communities, where a lot of great partners have been looking at ways to improve the total food system, including growing, harvesting, packaging, distribution, the whole system, and how we can make improvements in that.
You know, what you're really talking about is how interconnected everything is. And when you're doing intervention work, it's frequently a much more of a narrow focus. And when you're looking at that, what really creates change, it's not going to be one narrow intervention. But what you're really talking about is the interconnection of all of these different things that we may not have thought about.
Yeah, 100%. If these problems were easy enough to be solved by one entity or one person, they would have been solved a long time ago. In order to create change, you really need those collaborative networks. You need coalitions. You need the village to help solve these challenges. And that's why a key component of our systems change grant program at Vitalist is having a strong coalition. And if you don't have a strong coalition yet, what capacity building support can we leverage to help you form that coalition, identify those key core partners, the right people that need to be at the table to have a specific role and responsibility to help you achieve that systems change. And that coalition is important. And another key component to creating change is those closest to the problem should be closest to the solution. Mm-hmm. It's a way to hold a health equity lens in your work. So that is also a key component of our efforts here at Vitalist, is ensuring that those coalitions that we support are engaging those with lived experiences from the get-go, so that community is being heard, the grassroots partners, those experiencing tremendous health disparities, can be part of the solution as well.
Can you give an example where you have helped an organization or a coalition build the capacity to be a coalition?
Ooh, I feel like there's so many great examples. And it's always a tough question because it's almost like choosing your favorite kid. It's sort of, I have to choose my favorite grant partner.
You can choose several kids if you want. Go ahead.
I'll give you a Tucson-specific example, and it really comes to mind because we just hosted our learning session with our grant partners, because at Vitalist, we try to practice this concept of trust-based philanthropy. And one of the principles of trust-based is providing multi-year funding as flexible and general operating as possible, which we do through our grants program. But we have to go beyond the check, provide the check, but layer that with technical assistance and capacity building support that can help your partner address any challenges that they may be experiencing. We know that change happens within systems change efforts. So how, as a funding partner, are we actually being a partner and not just being more transactional? So we host these learning sessions, and one of the great coalitions that was at the table was a phenomenal partnership down in Pima County, led by the Pima County Attorney's Office, Pima County Public Defender's Office, and other community partners, to inform a restorative justice lens to the county criminal justice system. We know that criminal justice has direct health implications and impacts a person's ability to live a healthy life, for them to create a healthy family as well. And we know the data and the statistics with the inequities that exist, especially with people of color, Black and African-American communities, the Latino community. So to have those decision makers at the table, the Pima County Attorney's Office, the Pima County Public Defender's Office, and they're usually on the opposite mm-hmm. side of the courtroom, coming together saying, we want to have this restorative justice lens as part of our criminal justice system. So they're creating that and diversion programs so folks can actually be rehabilitated and see a way back into living a productive life. And this coalition is so awesome because not only do they have those two key partners, they have other community partners that are bringing both the persecutor and the victim to the table through kind of like a therapy circle with trained facilitators to help navigate and talk through what the issue was, how can it be addressed with the victim, and in a restorative way. And with those key partners coming together, it really just shows the strength of that coalition. And they've made a tremendous amount of progress. Of course, there are always hiccups when you're trying to implement systems change, especially in a system that is so entrenched, like our criminal justice system. But the partners are so committed and they're working so hard to meet this moment and really transform lives in Pima County. We hope that they then can replicate that model with other counties. And we have another effort very similarly led by Black Lives Matter of Phoenix Metro here in the urban core of Phoenix, working with the city of Tempe at the city level to do something similar. A little bit different approach, but they still are at the table with the city, bringing in community partners and just rocking and rolling on that front.
I'm thinking about coalition building, and there's some people who say it's hard. There's some people who say it's complex. If I came to you and I said, David, I'm thinking about a project, and you said, great, who are you partnering with? Where would you guide me? What are the steps that you would take me through to say, okay, here's how you build a coalition towards whatever it is that you're thinking about?
I would first have folks identify what their systems change is, what needs to change in that system. And once you begin to identify the change, you can really focus and narrow in on who is the person or the decision maker or the body that is holding that problem in place. And once you identify that, you can begin to think through who needs to be engaged in your system change efforts to help move that rock, to move that boulder, to move that stick in the mud. So that's how you begin to identify who your core partners can and should be. So for instance, with the Pima County effort, you have the Pima County Attorney's Office, you have the Pima County Public Defender's Office, you have community partners that are bringing those folks together to help in their restorative justice lens. So you have the right people at the table. And that's really important as well. But I would even encourage folks to take a step back and kind of look inwards. And it's sort of like dating a little bit. Before you put yourself out there, you know, and go on the market, you have to know yourself. You have to know what you like, what you want in a relationship. And the same thing with building a coalition. You have to know your organization. What are our strengths? What are our strengths as a partner? What are we bringing to the table? And what are our weaknesses, or what are our areas of opportunity? And once you begin to look at that list, you can say, okay, maybe I'm a stronger advocate or lobbyist, and maybe not so much grassroots engagement. So I need to find a partner that really has that grassroots engagement experience, especially to engage those with lived experience. Or maybe I have a skill set, or maybe my organization has a terrific, you know, communications and marketing person that can help boost the story and amplify the impact that we're trying to make. So that's what I'm bringing to the table. So then you can identify other people that have different skill sets that will be important to building up your coalition.
I love your emphasis of a weakness as an area of opportunity. That reframe is just so powerful, because when we think about nonprofits in general, the folks who would be applying for a grant from Vitalist, we are so seasoned to think of ourselves as weak. We are so seasoned to think of ourselves through that lens of scarcity. I remember teaching a workshop years ago, and it was on strength-based resource development. And I was looking for somebody in the audience, or about 100 people in the room, and I was looking for somebody in the audience to be the guinea pig, to say, you know, let's work on yours as the example for everybody in the workshop. And this one gal in the back of the room raised her hand, and she literally said the words, "Please pick me, we have nothing." And that has just so stuck with me. And of course, when we went through the exercise, she found that she had so much to work with. But we're so seasoned to think of ourselves as being weak. And so I love that framing of weakness as an area of opportunity to find somebody that can fill those gaps. That's so
absolutely
powerful.
I'm a pretty positive person normally. I feel like you know me well enough, Hildy, to know I'm a pretty rosy-eyed kind of guy. But there's so much negativity in the world. And again, one of the things I absolutely love about my role at Vitalist is I get to meet very passionate people doing the most with the least to improve the health of themselves, their families, their communities. And it's just so inspiring. So even in my most difficult day, or when you get in the weeds of grant making and reading and writing reports and all of this, I always just try to think and remind our team here as well, you know, there's a reason why we do what we do. And when we connect with our partners, they always remind us. So we actually just finished our mid-year check-ins with our partners. It was not intentionally planned like this. It just happened to be middle of the year. We changed into a new year, but it was perfectly timed because there's a lot going on in the world right now. There's a lot of concern and fear, a lot of changes and pivots that have to be made by our grant partners to meet the moment. And even though all of that is happening and there is rightfully a lot of fear and concern, they're still doing their work. It is just awesome. And not only are they just doing the work that we have a partnership with, they are doing a million other things, which is just so inspiring. I really do try to take a weakness as an area of opportunity, especially in coalition work. The same thing can be said about running a nonprofit. There's this kind of life cycle of nonprofits. There's a similar life cycle for coalitions. Change happens within systems change efforts, and you have to, as a coalition, be able to have these checkpoints to listen and learn and reflect and then take action based on the change that is happening. And the work that you're doing now may be completely different than what you started as doing. And that's okay. There's stages of coalition to initially be in startup phase, when you begin to really frame your effort, then you grow your effort, which is another big phase, and begin to mature as a coalition. That's really when you're at the top of your game. You're just running on all cylinders, which is great. You're really doing the work, you're proving the solutions, but then you might begin to see a little bit of a down curve. And either that can happen because maybe a key coalition partner left, maybe they won the lottery and had to go off to a beach or something, or maybe to stay on this whole positive thing, maybe part of your system change has already seeing some benefit. So your efforts aren't necessarily needed. So while that downturn may be seen as a negative, in many instances, it can be seen as a positive, because hopefully in the nonprofit sector, people are really working towards putting themselves out of a job. Imagine a day when we won't need food banks. It's possible if we make system change, if we really tackle the root causes of hunger and food insecurity. But one important thing is, if you're in that downturn, as a nonprofit or coalition, there's a turnaround opportunity. Change happens within systems change. So how is your coalition listening and learning from those changes needed and then actually implementing the change needed and having that turnaround moment so that you go back to this kind of startup and growth phase to eventually move into the more mature phase where you're rocking and rolling as a coalition and just really, really proving the solutions that you're bringing to the table.
That sense of agility, that's not something that we humans do very well. We like things to be the way we understand them and what we've gotten used to, and we like it when it's comfortable. Can you share just some of what you've seen in terms of the life cycle of a coalition and how that has come out? And I'd love to hear about successes that you've seen in terms of things actually changing.
Well, I'll pull out another great example from one of our partners up in Northern Arizona now, because while we're based in Phoenix, Vitalist has partners across the great state of Arizona. The Coconino Coalition for Children and Youth based out of Flagstaff, but they serve Coconino County and really the extended Northern Arizona area, including tribal communities. And they've really brought together a really strong coalition of folks working in the trauma-informed space. And their whole effort was really to inform city and county government using that trauma-informed lens to recognize that folks that are coming to the door of government for support or to nonprofits for support are doing so because of likely intergenerational trauma. But one of the things I really, really appreciated about a presentation that they had was a speaker said, yes, we know intergenerational trauma exists. The data and the science, we know that that trauma can be embedded in a person's DNA. But because we know intergenerational trauma exists, we know intergenerational solutions can exist. And it's this whole concept rooted in indigenous practice of seven generations, of really trying to solve a problem that seven generations from now, they will reap the benefits of. And then that generation looks seven generations ahead. I love that practice. And it's the same way with, I think, coalition. So the Coconino Coalition for Children and Youth have built a strong coalition. They've convened folks to talk about, inform themselves about what trauma-informed practices are, which is really important. And because things change at any government level, right, for that matter, elections, change in leadership, change in administration, lack of resources, so many things can change when your target decision maker is a government institution. That's certainly the case that they're experiencing there. But they are so committed to continuing to work with the city and county to inform their own decision making at the government level using this trauma-informed lens. And they've been able to build a really strong team and have continued to just reinvigorate their effort.
So which part of the curve are they at right now?
Here's another piece of it too. So the coalition as a whole is on a life cycle, right? So I think as a whole, the coalition might be a bit on this turnaround phase to think through, okay, how do we have to pivot as we continue to focus on implementing a trauma-informed lens with city and county governments? But one of the things about coalitions is it's not easy. There are so many layers to bringing coalitions together, right? Both because you have partners with their own respective agendas, and it may not be nefarious. You know, you're coming to a space wearing an organizational hat, but you don't necessarily have to take that hat off. But when you're working in coalition, you have to think about the greater good, the collective impact potential, not just for your one entity. So you have to balance that. And then you have to balance these other aspects that make a coalition strong or areas of opportunity that coalitions have. So maybe one aspect of a coalition is you have to have a really bold goal and strategy. And sometimes people get mission drift, you know, coalitions get mission drift, nonprofits get mission drift, and you might begin to stray from whatever that initial bold goal and strategy was. So that component of a coalition is in and of itself on a life cycle. Similarly, things like shared leadership, coalition leadership governance is so challenging because you might have power dynamics to balance with. Maybe a stronger institutional partner is the backbone organization and not being attuned to what more grassroots community-based organizations are saying and their role in coalitions. So shared leadership has a whole component of life cycles. So when you're thinking about these different components of a coalition, like bold goals and strategies, shared leadership, stakeholder engagement, financial sustainability, communications, the culture of a coalition, each of those components is on its own life cycle, while the coalition as a whole is on its own life cycle as well. A lot to manage, which is why it's so important that we have a focus on coalition capacity building even before we begin to plan and implement our systems change.
It's sort of like a marriage. We think that, the most important thing is we get married. No, the work starts after that. Absolutely. Yep. Absolutely. What you're really talking about are what are the conditions for success for not just the project out in the world, but what are the conditions for success for this relationship? Because a coalition really is just a relationship. And what does it take? What needs to be in place for that relationship to maintain and continue to be strong as things change, as leadership changes, as people move in and out, as conditions change out in the world? What does it take for that relationship to stay strong? That is a really powerful thing to be thinking about, because so often we are coming together around the thing we want to change out in the world. And as you noted earlier, so much of it depends on how we be, both as individuals and collectively. It's a fascinating way to think about it.
I love the analogy of a relationship. And I also love the analogy that is used more so in the nonprofit organizational development framing, but I think it can be mirrored very similarly for coalition capacity building. It's actually a model or a frame that that is supported through the Nonprofit Life Cycles Institute. And it's a table. It's a four-legged table. And we've all been at a restaurant with a wobbly table leg, and it's so annoying. And you try to jam a napkin underneath it, but it's still wobbly. And your dinner, it can ruin a dinner, right? So the whole idea is address the wobbly table leg. Really, don't just stuff napkins under it. Really figure out maybe you need to tighten up the peg, or, you know, make it adjust the height of the peg or whatnot. But the four-legged table, imagine on top of a table, you have this beautiful vase with flowering blooms. Imagine that as like the mission, your bold goal and strategy. You want those flowers to be popping, right? You want that it to be healthy. You need to water it. You need to provide nutrients and whatnot. That mission, that bold goal and strategy, the flowers stand atop the tabletop, which are the programs, the programmatic aspects of your, in this case, nonprofits. Really, you need that strong tabletop to support the mission. The tabletop, the programs are supported by four table legs. And again, this is more so for traditional nonprofits and not necessarily coalitions. I like to say a coalition probably has more like 10 table legs. You need a big table to fit all of your core partners. But in this nonprofit life cycles framework, the four table legs that are standing up your programs, that are supporting your missions, are management, governance, a business model, and administrative systems. You really need those four key components to run a really successful nonprofit. And again, if one of those table legs is wobbly, if, say, your governance is wobbly, maybe you are growing your board, or your board doesn't understand their roles around fundraising, or there's transition at the management level, that's a wobbly table leg. So now we know what needs to be addressed. How can we fix that wobbly table leg so that your table legs can be strong and support the tabletop, your programs that is supporting your mission, your bold goal and strategy, those flowers that we want to be blooming?
Yeah, I love that analogy. Love that. You know, I'm coming back to the mandate that you talked about earlier, that the people who are affected are at the table, are part of that decision. We so often see people coming together in their professional roles. So organizations coming together, five groups come together, 10 groups come together from different aspects of an issue. But what we don't so frequently see is the actual people with the lived experience, the people who will be affected by whatever decision is being made. We frequently don't see them being involved. The first question, as you and I have talked about, the first question in catalytic thinking is, who is going to be affected by whatever we are considering, and what will it take for them to, at minimal, participate in this decision and hopefully lead the direction that we take? And it's interesting how many people think, yeah, but that's hard. I have a dear friend who will say, it's hard or not. And I love that. What have you seen in terms of what it takes to engage real people? It's real easy to find other organizations. We're listed. You can go online and find them. But what does it take to really engage real people in these coalitions?
In answering this question, I'll tell another story of a previous Vitalist partner, again, down in Tucson. I think that if you are an organization, an institution coming at an issue, not yet engaging community, the first thing I would say is look at the disaggregated data. You know the issue or the health outcome you hope to improve, but can start very broad, like I want to improve diabetes rates in the state of Arizona. Very noble goal, but who are those most impacted by those diabetes rates? Where are they? What populations? What communities? And when you begin to look at that disaggregated data, you begin to know and be able to identify those people that should be part of your coalition, part of the solution. Say one of the most tremendous health disparities in Arizona is maternal health. Maternal health overall in Arizona is an issue. But if you look at the disaggregated data, those populations, especially with the largest health disparities, are Black and African American mothers and Indigenous mothers. So that's where you begin to look at, okay, now I know what specific populations to look at. So I need to be engaging those community members, those community partners that have those folks and serving those folks as part of my solution. So one great example of this is actually a previous Vitalist grant partner, initially led by Southwest Folklife Alliance, based out of the University of Arizona, the great people that bring us Tucson Meet Yourself. They have brought together a really strong network of community partners along the 12th Avenue corridor, or La Doce, as they call it. And the whole concept is Tucson is growing. We want to be able to support multimodal transportation options, including down 12th Avenue. We want to embrace the community that exists in South Tucson and the south side of Tucson along 12th Avenue as more and more people are going down there to enjoy the great food, among other things. But in order to determine what that community looks like, what 12th Avenue looks like, the community has to decide that. People that have lived there for generations and generations, they have family homes, they have family small businesses. So this coalition and Southwest Folklife Alliance is out of the University of Arizona. So talk about an institutional partner, right? But they were so intentional with engaging community through really, really fun practices. Community engagement doesn't have to be boring or always burdensome. It is hard work, to be sure. But in this instance, they partnered with U of A College of Architecture. And they used this really fascinating community design process where they invited community together at a time and place that was comfortable for communities, meeting people where they're at, very important. I'm sure they had food, maybe childcare, or some fun activities for kids as well. But they gave families a Lego set and said, here is our Legos components to reflect how you want 12th Avenue to look like. So they literally used Legos to design the street design. So you had like this Lego, kind of a flat Lego, which was, you know, the street. I think it was green for like green space. And then people were able to build different buildings or houses, trees for shade, seating areas. So they used Legos as a way to get community input, a fun way, an authentic way of engaging community. I absolutely love that. And they still have those, actually. So when I went down for a site visit at one of their community events, they had the Legos out and different families had different components, and they were actually able to inform through that community, that fun community input project, ways to redesign 12th Avenue and have it be reflective of what the community actually wanted.
You're talking about such a different approach than we are used to with what basically is road construction. Mm-hmm. When we're looking at the alignment of a street or what's going to be on that street, the city gets in there, makes the decision that something will happen in that area, and then hires engineers to come up with three different options. They spend a buttload of money doing that. Yep. And then they bring that quote to the community and they say, well, we have a community participation process because the community now gets to choose among the three options that we created in the first place. And what you're really talking about is turning that on its head and saying, no, the community is going to decide. A, where is the problem area? And B, what do we want it to look like? That's a very, very different framing.
Absolutely. Yeah, and some of the design around this, speed was a big factor. 12th Avenue is a high traffic corridor area, a lot of traffic, fast moving cars. So their kids play in the neighborhood, in those streets. So they wanted to create crosswalks, paths, speed bumps, different speed mitigation tactics, you know, like smaller roundabouts and whatnot. And sure, when you don't live in that area and you're driving through it, it's now a burden, but it's what community wanted. It's what they really desired. And that's what was implemented.
Yeah, we need to be thinking in terms of people's living rooms. We need to be thinking in terms of people's homes and their lives. And that's really what you're talking about, is that bottom-up feeling. I remember a project that we did a long time ago where we were investigating what was going on in various communities around Arizona, actually. And we were in Prescott, and it was an anti-meth campaign. So it was quite a while ago when pre-fentanyl, we had the meth issue. Not that we don't still have that. And what they had brought together was a coalition of not just folks involved in criminal justice, but people who had been through the system. So what does it look like for someone who was addicted to meth? What does it look like for somebody who was arrested? What does it look like for their family if they're in prison? And brought all of those folks to the table to address the issues. Because what they found is what you would expect, is that it's the things that we who are not involved in that would go, wow, I never thought of that. Wow, I never thought of that. And to me, the success that I see in coalitions is the number of times in a meeting that you hear the words, I never thought of it, or I never thought of it that way. That's when you know you've got a really good mix of people at the table.
Yeah, absolutely. We're seeing that right now with the whole portfolio area around housing, because we know how much of a crisis that is here in Arizona, really across the country, especially in rural areas. And there are really promising practices that are happening that we're really trying to support, like utilizing vacant school properties, vacant church properties, vacant properties on other kind of government institutional lands like community colleges or community health centers. And it not only addresses the housing affordability issue, because it can increase the supply that's in those communities, but for those anchor institutions like a community health center or a school, it's helping with workforce recruitment and retention. Because if a teacher can't live in the community of their school, that's a problem, because then you might not be reflective of the students and the families that you're serving. Or similarly for doctors that work at community health centers or other hospitals. So we've been partnering with a lot of school districts, especially in rural parts of Arizona, to tackle these challenges and build affordable workforce housing on vacant school properties. And in addition to that, think about what other uses are available for that property. So if you, and we see this a lot in like urban areas, if you're building a 5-story affordable workforce housing to meet your need of the school down the streets, the first level, can that be a childcare facility or a laundromat or a community health center or another service that those families living on floors 2, 3, 4, and 5 can utilize? And a lot of folks that are working in institutions like city governments, we've been in rooms where they've been like, oh, we never thought about that. So it seems like such a no-brainer. But when we know transportation is an issue for a lot of folks that would utilize affordable housing, then yeah, they probably need childcare that's close, or a laundromat, or a community health center, or a fresh market. It could be a lot of different things. So we're really trying to use that kind of multi-use development concept, equitable development.
It's also thinking about, and I'm coming back to your phrasing of weakness as an area of opportunity. There are so many communities, I think in just about every community, there is vacant storefronts, or there is a particular street that has a lot of vacant storefronts, or vacant land, as you were talking about. And we see that as a blight. We see that as a burden. And It really takes a very different mindset to say, what do we have to build upon? When we're asking what we have to build upon, we've got a place that's empty. Oh, and by the way, we need some space.
Yeah.
We don't really think so often about what we have as an asset to build upon. And that strength-based approach, I know, has always been a part of what Vitalist is about. It's one of the reasons I always love talking to you, David. And this has just been, I love the focus on networks and coalitions and what it really takes to both bring people together and keep them together. I mean, that's almost sometimes the bigger part is what it takes to keep them together. And so really appreciate your being with us today. And we will definitely have to do more of this conversation because I know our listeners are going to want to go, okay, so what next?
Yeah, what next? Definitely go to vitalisthealth.org. We have a publications page where we have put together some thought partnership with awesome local and national partners to better reflect on what we mean by systems change, help folks better understand what system change is so that they can think about taking that approach in their work. We also have resources around coalition building and what the capacity building components are of those collaborative networks who eventually work towards systems change. And of course, we have an open door policy at Vitalist. So if you are working in coalition towards systems change, please reach out to us. Go to vitalisthealth.org, complete what we call our discovery intake form so we can discover partnership. It would be great to connect with you.
And the fabulous thing about all of the resources that Vitalist has online is even if you are outside of your grant-making zone, if you're outside of Arizona, all of those resources are still available for folks, which we absolutely appreciate. David, thank you so much for being with us today.
Yeah, thank you so much, Hildy, for all of the work that you're doing to support systems change work as well.
I'm so grateful to David for sharing his observations and experience with us. While everything he works on at Vitalist is rooted in systems change, David's emphasis on building coalitions is what's so striking, that achieving real systemic change requires that we include all the people who will be affected. The phrasing of those closest to the problem should be closest to the solution is reminiscent of the phrase nothing about us without us that originally arose in the disability rights movement. From there, though, there's so much power in the strength-based approach David and the team at Vitalist use in their coalition-building efforts. Seeing weakness as an opportunity, what a powerful way to turn that around. At the core, whatever you call it, coalitions or collaboratives or partnership, the success of any effort will rely on the relationships that are built and sustained. And David's stories reinforce that at every turn. You can learn more about David's work at the podcast page for this episode. And of course, if this episode got you thinking, we hope you'll share this podcast with your friends and colleagues and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And as always, you can learn more about Creating the Future's work at creatingthefuture.org. Thank you for being with us today and for wanting to create a better future for our world. We'll see you next time here at Creating the Future.